I actually thought they were hustling me. I was like, why would you pay me this much money and pay me to go to school? I was like, where's the gimmick at?
Hello, welcome to Money Honestly. I'm Lionel Foster. Corey McRae remembers when legally earning $12 an hour was the start of something big for him. But he had no idea that would lead to overseeing $60 billion. Senator McRae, as I like to call him, became a Maryland state legislator in 2015 and a member of the state Senate's powerful Budget and Taxation Committee in 2019. Most people, he says, did not know him when he was in juvenile detention. We can't imagine that version of his life. Becoming a trainee electrician was the start of what his more recent friends and colleagues see today. He titled his new book, The Apprenticeship That Saved My Life. And he means that literally.
I nearly started by saying, Corey, welcome to Money Honestly, but you have earned this, Senator Corey McRae. Thank you for joining
Corey,
me, honestly.
Corey, it is. Corey, it is. I appreciate you, my friend. And let me be clear, I'm honored, I'm privileged, humbled to be here today with you.
All right. Well said. Corey, what's your money origin story?
You know what? When I think about my money origin story, I think about my mom, who was a single mom. I think about family not really understanding how money works. But my mom, I mess with her and she messes with me. She said I can make two nickels scream. Some of the things that I've been able to learn at a young age, I've then been able to move over to the age that I'm at now and try to pass that along to my young folks in my house, Lionel. I think of it, you know, not as just an electrician, but also as an entrepreneur. I've been purchasing homes up and down the Bel Air Road corridor since the age of 20. I think of it as a public servant who serves on the Budget and Taxation Committee in the Maryland State Senate. But I want to be clear, it's a $60 plus billion budget. So it's 13 people chopping up $60 billion, making sure that our values and our priorities are reflected in that beautiful document.
I can make two nickels scream. Oh my goodness. I love black people. I just have an opportunity to say that because who else comes up with stuff like that? That's amazing.
Right. I was offended at first, and then I realized she's just saying like this. He uniquely saves and knows how to put a puzzle together.
Yeah. Tell us more about how you grew up. And this was, of course, in Baltimore, but the audience for this is well beyond Baltimore. Describe that for us.
No, I appreciate that, man. I'm a son of Baltimore. I'm born and raised. I grew up in a space called Seminole Apartments, so I can remember my mom moving back and forth. And like us doing well was like moving from the bottom floor of the apartment to the top floor of the apartment was a big deal. I've always excelled at elementary school. Unfortunately, met a number of challenges when entering into middle school. I think that our young men have that shift that happens in their life where they're trying to figure it out, trying to figure out if they're going to succumb to peer pressure, things of that nature. And Lionel, I was removed out of a number of middle schools. So I went to Rockland, Chicopee, Winston. High school, I went to Emerson for 4 months, Northern a year and a half, and I graduated from Fairmont Harford. And I tell folks, Lionel, that by the grace of God, that I had a mom that never gave up on her son. It was my mother who actually reached out to the Maryland Department of Labor and said, send me every apprenticeship program in the state of Maryland. And it was there where they were laying out 5 years, what my 5-year trajectory would be. And you know, 2003, when I started, $12 an hour, 2000, the next year, $15 an hour, the next year, $18 an hour, up until when it matriculated up to $32 an hour. And I could kind of see the board a lot more clear after that being put in front of me with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And I tell folks, I went in there and I started working around people that not only were electricians, but they had outside things going on. So I can remember purchasing my first home at the age of 20 simply because I was around other people and getting out of the small universe that I knew. So I knew the four blocks that I grew up on, but I didn't know anything outside of Baltimore. This gave me that ability to be around individuals that were homeowners, landlords, corner store owners. And Lionel, I would look across and say, I know I'm smarter than that guy over there. So all I would duplicate the stuff that they would put together, man. And I learned from there. I'll let you ask some more questions. I don't want to unpack it too much, but just like I'm just humbled and blessed to be in a position that I'm in right now.
That's fantastic. It sounds like apprenticeships, the structure around it, the support around it, possibly even a mentorship component were hugely important for you. Can you describe that pathway? I think you already said a little bit about how you got on it, but how old were you and what did the next several years look like?
So when I graduated from high school, I was trying to figure it out. A lot of our young people are graduating high school and they do not know what's next. And I applaud the people that do, but there's a large percentage out there that don't. I didn't know that I would eventually be an electrician. I never even heard of apprenticeships. I didn't realize that this opportunity was within 15 or 20 minutes of my house, to be honest with you, Lionel. But what it did was it gave me, I actually thought they were hustling me. I was like, why would you pay me this much money and pay me to go to school? I was like, where's the gimmick at? Are you going to put me out my third year? And I realized that there are employers that have a business model that they value having a trained workforce. So now I started to understand that their business model works, and that's why they were paying us the pay that we made.
So you and I both come from the hood, hoods in Baltimore, and you're looking at that going, where's the hustle?
Right. Like, like, help me understand. Like, this is too good to be true. And I say that in saying, like, my mom had worked for the state. Folks know that state workers don't make a lot of money. They have good benefits and they have good retirement is what it is. But my mom had made $35,000 a year. And you're telling me that you're going to pay me at the end of this 5 years twice as much as most of the people in my family. I said, where do you sign me up at? And this, like I said, it can't be real. And Lionel, you hit a home run when you said mentorship. So I think about the mentorship that I was able to learn going through this 5-year apprenticeship program. And I can remember getting those raises. So when it matriculated from 12 to 15, a lot of folks went out there and they grabbed car payments. I did. Every year I bought a house. So like the every year. So my second year, I bought a house on Pelham. Third year, I bought a house on Kenyon. Fourth year, I bought a house on Ravenwood. And then the fifth year, I bought two houses and a duplex. Because I was like, I can bank this money and treat it like I'd never even had it. And I didn't really know what I was doing. All that I knew was that this was what the people that I was working around was doing. Nobody taught me that houses appreciate. Nobody taught me the tax shelter. Nobody had taught me these basic fundamentals that I know now that I pay forward now and make sure that folks understand. But that I wasn't clear on at that moment. And before I jump right back to it, I'll say how I wasn't clear on it. I can remember Mike Rowley asked me a question. Do you have a line of credit on the homes that you own? I had three of them at the time. I said, well, what's a line of credit? He was talking about a HELOC, a home equity line of credit. And he said, well, what if you wanted to walk away right today? How would you access that cash? And I said, I never thought about it. And I didn't realize that I had untapped money inside of it because I had equity in the homes. Lionel, it didn't change my whole position. I had about $100,000 equity, had a line of credit on each one, and then I can make the offer cash versus then trying to get a loan, making sure the conditions are met and things of that nature. It was a different conversation that I was having with the seller.
So the line of credit on an existing property funds the next property.
So the line of credit, and what you do is that line of credit that I had, I then would get a quick deal, maybe go to closing in 30 days or less. And then I would go pick up another mortgage and then I return that money back to the line of credit so that I'm not wasting it on anything, doing anything frivolous with it, but like making sure. And I would just repeat the cycle.
Corey, where did that discipline come from? Let me back up. Well, maybe we'll come back to that one. You grow up in resource constrained environments. And mm-hmm. if your area was like my area, mm-hmm. the people we had the most access to who made the most money, we're getting that money illegally. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they grew up around some of the same constraints our parents had, we had, mm-hmm. and they made certain choices given those constraints.
Yep.
I imagine those paths were open to you as well, but you chose very differently. Why?
Yep. So I tell you, I actually fell victim and succumbed to the behavior that I saw when I walked out the house each and every day. So I told you about my K-12 experience. Mm-hmm. And I just got finished writing this book. It gets released on September 30th, Lionel. But I speak to how I was engaged in the juvenile justice system. I speak to how I was in the adult system twice as a juvenile. So like all of those same things. And I didn't realize, why is there a concentration of liquor stores in certain neighborhoods versus the other? Why is there no healthy food options? I didn't understand those types of dynamics when I was young. But one of the things is, and I'll go back to it, I had a very pivotal moment in my life. And it was when I was 18, Lionel. When I was 18, 30 days before my birthday, I was incarcerated in the juvenile justice system for 10 months. I came home for those 30 days, wasn't even home for 30 days, and I'm incarcerated again, and this time charged as an adult, Lionel. And I can remember being in the visiting room, and we got visits on Sundays. And I can remember seeing my mom for the first time that I'm incarcerated. And I can see her walking in that visiting room, and I'm having this conversation with Lionel, and I'm telling her to give up on me. I'm saying I'm too far gone, and I'm tired of hurting this woman.
Remind me how old you are at this point.
I'm 17 and I'm about a week away from my 18th birthday.
Okay.
And I can remember her saying to me, Lionel, I'm going to keep believing in you until you believe in yourself. Lionel, I turned 18 over this place, L section, which is Baltimore City Jail. I then come home and I told you my mom was the one that reached out to the Department of Labor and said, Corey, go fill out applications at all of these places. Luckily, I was accepted into the apprenticeship program, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And I was just doing and having a conversation with a friend. And she said, Corey, do you realize that at 18, you were over to Baltimore City Jail? And do you realize what you said? At 20, you were a homeowner.
Yeah.
That then shifted my trajectory so quick, so vast. I'd never been on a plane until I was 25. I never left the country until I was 30. So I was very limited and what my exposure and access looked like. That then just bust my world wide open. You talked about like the skill sets that you learn to be disciplined. I learned them from the streets all my life. I just needed to figure out how do I put them to something productive versus negative to my neighborhood, which is why, again, why I said I wrote that book, The Apprenticeship to Save My Life, simply because I've got this 20 years of knowledge capture. I know that there are mothers, guidance counselors, parents, teachers, that are still trying to figure out the conversation and what that sounds like for people like myself, people that grew up in our zip codes, and like trying to put these tough, complex puzzles together, Lionel. And I just say, just thank you for amplifying that conversation and asking the question, calling the question.
Man, you have more than earned it. Okay, sure, I'm amplifying it, but my goodness, the substance is worth sharing. What do you do for a living?
So I laugh because I got four children, and I should have started with that. So I've known my wife, Demetria, since I was 17, and we have our four children, Kennedy, Reagan, CJ, and Bryson. And my oldest daughter had sent me a text when we had wrote the book and said, I'm so proud of you. So I say this in saying that I'm an electrician. I went through that 5-year apprenticeship program through the IBEW. Maryland State Senator. So I currently serve, and this is my 12th year. I'm going to my 12th session in the Maryland General Assembly. But now, as of September 30th, I'll have the title author. And that's why she was sending me the text. Just letting her know, like, it's no boxes. You can do anything you put your mind to. Just please dream big and always shoot for the stars so that your dreams are always going to be there within reach.
Say more about your path through the legislature. I can imagine not all of your colleagues had the upbringing that you did.
I tell you, it's a different lived experience. So I think that my colleagues value me being there because I can see the board a lot more different. I know. So like, I can remember I wasn't elected when we met to anything. And my attitude towards politics was they leave me alone, I leave them alone. So I didn't even vote. So like, I didn't really start understanding the importance of policy until like my mid to late 20s. And I realized at some point in life, like, Corey, you're blessed. And you said, I say it so much. I say I'm blessed 10 times over, man. And I tried to figure out like, how did I get across this finish line? And I looked to my left, I looked to my right, and the number of my peers that I had grown up with wasn't across that same finish line, Lionel. Mm-hmm. And I realized I was always chasing money. But the true measure of success is how many people can you get across the finish line with you?
Okay.
The money's going to come. And I'm always trying my best to bless and pour in to add value to other people because it comes back to me tenfold. But you asked me the question, how did I get there? I realized I was blessed. I got across this finish line. And I think there are two ways that you change trajectory in our neighborhoods. I think that one of them is by showing folks how to create generational wealth, which we just had a conversation in reference to the real estate, owning land, things of that nature. But also the second piece is removing arbitrary barriers baked in public policy.
Okay.
Is one of the challenges that we have. I went in the House of Delegates, man. In 2015, I was sworn in. And let me be clear, it was a tough campaign because in Maryland, you only have to be one of three. We came in third place. So third place got us in the House of Delegates. And Lionel, we've hit the ground running as soon as we got there. First bill that I worked on was voting rights. Restoring voting rights to folks that were on parole or probation, they did not get the right to vote until 2016 in the state of Maryland. Apprenticeships is how I got my opportunity, expanding apprenticeship opportunities. We worked on minimum wage. We worked on SNAP benefits. We worked on keeping libraries open. I passed over 100 bills during my tenure in the Maryland General Assembly, and I'm super proud of the work.
You did some time as a juvenile. Mm-hmm. And now you're a legislator. You are a lawmaker, and you were on the other side of the law early in your life. Was there ever a point when that criminal record interfered with something you wanted to accomplish?
Yep. So I tell folks that my lived experience, and when we say that, I just want to make sure that the listening audience understand. I'd been in and out of the juvenile justice system since I was 13. So I'd been committed the first time when I was 13 years old for a stolen handgun. And that happened 14, 15, not 16, because I was telling you about the 10 months that I was actually away. And then I told you about my 18th birthday. And I didn't realize this, Lionel, that the people that know me now can only see me in the last 5 years. So they don't really have a full understanding. If they just kind of like, hey, I met Corey and he's like this awesome person, really down to earth, really grounded and things. So they only can see me through the lens that they've seen me from that piece of it. But there are folks that know my story. When I go to see my barber, who's been cutting my head for the past since I was 13, 14 years old, like they understand and they're so proud. But the question that you ask is, has that impeded my trajectory in the General Assembly? I ran a very tough campaign, so I only sat in the House of Delegates for one term, and I realized that the power was in the Maryland State Senate, and I decided to challenge the second highest senator in the state of Maryland in a primary election, which is a big no-no. That's a very untraditional, and what happens is during that time, folks were trying to use that against me, but what happens is I've always been very honest. I might not have that conversation with a lot of adults, but young folks that's going through similar situations, trying to figure it out, I've never hidden from that. And I've always tried to share some of the paths that I've had in front of it. Did it impede me? No, I think that people have a value on something when folks have a lived experience. They know where my heart is. They know that I have a will to serve. They know that I have a work ethic. And when they tried to do it, we won by 17 points. So the race wasn't even close.
You are a steward of one of several stewards of literally billions of dollars. So yep. Please talk about that work, going from figuring out $12, $13 an hour to working with billions.
Yep. So I was like, how did a young boy from Baltimore City end up on the Budget and Taxation Committee? And I'm going to repeat it again, man, because sometimes I'm blown away. A $60-plus billion budget. And why I said the power was over in the Maryland State Senate. In the House of Delegates, there are 141 members. In the Maryland State Senate, there are only 47. And those four committees, there are four standing committees that are evenly split. So it's 13 members that are having this hard, challenging conversation about a $60-plus billion budget. And if I could be honest, then there comes the part where you have some decision makers. Typically, it's the chair of the committee, it's the vice chair, but the subcommittee chairs are also in that conversation. And I chair Health and Human Services. So all things health, all things human services come through my purview at this point in time. So I regularly meet with our health secretary at least 3 to 4 times a month, understanding our challenges and our strengths. At that point in time, I meet with our DHS, Rafael Lopez, at least 3 or 4 times a month, understanding some of the strengths and weaknesses within the Human Services Agency for the state of Maryland. And I just got finished meeting with Dr. Rice. She leads on education. But what happens is when you're in that room, you're having these hard conversations around education and what we're going to do about it, how we're going to fund it, what does that look like, who does it impact, I can make sure that I lean in with my values that I know my colleagues trust. When we're having a hard conversation about public transit or the lack thereof, I can have a different type of lived experience because I caught public transit going to K-12 school. I have 4 children that currently catch or caught public transit from that standpoint. When we think about SNAP benefits and the challenges facing our families, and I worked on legislation for June, July, and August, because sometimes the only meal that our young folks will receive is at school. And this is a normal. Sometimes we're normalizing the unnormal. But we now think about what does that look like, and we fund it so that we're thinking about June, July, and August. The last one that I'll hit you with, because this is where people have to understand their power and why it's important to be engaged. Lydell, we in the city of Baltimore, from a public safety standpoint, 2020, it was horrendous around murders and non-fatal shootings. And I can remember in the Fort Worthington community, one of my neighbors coming up to me, Corey, what are you going to do about the multiple homicides that have happened at the intersection of Milton? And when doing so, we then took the data and we looked at where this was happening and what was the correlation. There was a liquor store. I didn't realize that our liquor stores in the city of Baltimore were open 20 out of a 24-hour day. And I didn't realize that the adjacent counties, Baltimore, Howard, Anne Arundel, did not have that. They had normal operating hours. And I realized that's my power. I'm the state government, and that falls under the state purview. So in East Baltimore, you'll find that our liquor establishments, from North Avenue to McEldrey to Luzerne to Central Avenue, and 23 of them in a 1-mile radius, Alano, I couldn't believe it. They were open. Like, why is that level of concentration there? And then they no longer open up at from 6 a.m. to 2 a.m. They now open up 9 a.m. and they close at 10 p.m. And we saw a drastic reduction in fatal shootings and non-fatal shootings the next year, simply because no one was congregating at 11, midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., or 2:30, because when you close, you don't immediately leave. But those are the things that are within our construct, and one of the reasons why I love being in the legislature, because I fully understand the power that we have and use for community.
That's an incredibly powerful solution. And you're saying, for all intents and purposes, no one really had a handle on what was going on. That analysis started in your office.
Yep. And just imagine that it operated like that for decades. I'd never known the liquor stores not to operate 20 outside of the day. But like, we always had the power. We never chose to use it. And nobody has a problem now. We're making national news in reference to the drops in homicides across that. But that's one of the pieces of the puzzle. And that's low hanging fruit. It's common sense. It should have never been that. It never should have been that way. And I go back to the point where I said, we normalize the unnormal.
Yes. You're taking me back, Corey, to my neighborhood. I live very close to that intersection you just named, Milton and Biddle. I grew up in that area. And so folks have heard how you grew up and the circles you travel in now. And you said some of the people you meet more recently, they only know the Corey from the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. But man, this is taking me back. So I remember I went to Johns Hopkins undergrad. From there, I studied in the UK for 3 years. I come back home. And it wasn't until I was 25 that it occurred to me. I'm remembering some of the fast food carryouts in the community, often owned by Asian proprietors, had, you know, late hours. And one feature was that was bulletproof glass.
That's true.
It was certainly glass. I always assumed it was bulletproof, but let's say for all intents and purposes, it was actually bulletproof. I was used to, from maybe the age of 4, well into my 20s and 30s, if I needed a quick bite to eat or a snack, I would go into an establishment where there was a literal physical division, bulletproof divider between the folks that work there and the patrons, and each side was quite wary of the other. And when you talk about normalizing things that shouldn't be normalized, it never occurred to me until I, oh my goodness, I'm in my 20s. I'm in New Jersey visiting a friend. We go to her suburban New Jersey town's equivalent of a carryout. And I go, oh, there's no bulletproof glass. And it is taking me literally decades to fully process this. One, to recognize that it was a thing, that what I grew up with was not necessarily normal, certainly wasn't all that healthy. And then, okay, to take that in, to deal with it, to talk to other people about it, to reach some level of acceptance and then appreciation for where I am now. So much of what Baltimore gave me is gold. I love it. I would not be who I am without it. Elements of what I grew up with were incredibly detrimental. And like I said, I'm still working through all of that.
Yeah, but the grit they can't take away from, and this is so important of a conversation of why exposure and access. I tell folks, I'm in my 30s and I leave the country for the first time. And I'd never seen people drinking water on the street. Like they got water fountains on the street. I'm like, we can't even drink water in our schools. And this country has figured out how to have access to public drinking water on the street. I look at energy, how it's different. Food, how it's different. The police station, when we went in the police station, it felt like more of an art museum in Switzerland versus a police station that we dealt with. And it was a public space. And what happens is when you get that access and exposure, it's the similar analogy when I told you about the person that owned these homes. And I'm like, I can now see the board a lot more clear. I now know what I need to do. I can see what I'm trying to aim for. What am I trying to shoot for? And it makes us better human beings.
I want to hear about some of the support and love you get from people who know the full trajectory of Corey, from the hood to the legislature. So, for example, I'll give you one of my own examples. I am in my second or third year as an undergrad at Johns Hopkins. And Mondawmin Mall is just a few miles from the Homewood campus. I was at Mondawmin. And, you know, Mondawmin socioeconomically, very different neighborhood from the Homewood campus. It's Mondawmin, you know, blacker, lower income. The campus I was on, you know, unfortunately, very often when you were on Hopkins campus at that time, it didn't really feel like you were in Baltimore anymore. But of course, I would travel back. So I'm at Mondawmin. I catch a cab back from whatever I was picking up from Mondawmin. The cab driver is African-American man. I'm about 20 at this point. He must have been late 40s, early 50s. And I had to tell him where I was going. I said, Homewood campus, Johns Hopkins University. And he goes, okay. And he looks at me and he says, are you a student there? I said, yes, sir, I am. And you know, our people, a lot of black folk in Baltimore, they don't pronounce the S in Johns. So for them is, you go to Johns Hopkins? You go to, and Corey, he might as well have been my uncle. He might as well have been my big brother. The joy he felt because I was in a position to attend a university that prestigious and that he got to take me there. Nothing in the world like it, man. I was a stranger to this man, yet somehow, of course, we were not strangers. And I'm just imagining, you're going into a recreation center. You're going into any building where you were part of the funding to make it possible. You're showing up at your kid's school and what these young people might see. But I want you to tell that.
Man, it's a lot that's circling in my mind right now. I think I get to live that every day in reference to running into high school classmates, folks that went to school with me, folks that may have been in a neighborhood, and they just like proud. It's a deep Baltimorean, like, man, you made it. And like, you ain't just stopped. You ain't just thinking about yourself. Like, you're trying to figure this puzzle out for all these other people. And then I quickly identify with our young folks because, like, when they, the same neighborhood that they grew up in. I'm like, I grew up in, I'm in the same condition. So I try my best to stay in one of our schools at least once a week, because I think it's important for them to see people that look like them and know that they can do anything that they put their minds to, but also having a very honest conversation. Lionel, a lot of adults might not have known my story, but these young folks know, because I'm trying to give them the path that they can do whatever it is. And when you talk about like things like funding, like I fought my tail off for this school, Furley Elementary, who left the conditions under emergency closure and I had to go to the old third. But we cut the ribbon on that brand new $30+ million school that is phenomenal, probably the best elementary school in the state of Maryland. 100% clean energy, like just phenomenal from there. But like, they knew why I was fighting. I know how important my education experience and where I veered off at and what they deserve from there. When we talk about the having the courage to take on businesses or establishments that's open for 20 hours, I'm impacting somebody's bottom line. But at the end of the day, like, it's about health incomes. It's about the mental that we are telling our young folks that we prioritize their education over a liquor store that's open at 6 a.m. and your school bell don't ring till 8 a.m. So like, they know that I'm doing it for the right reasons. And I just, the most important thing that I can do is just show up and just be present. But to your question, how do your folks feel when they see you and they see you in this position? It's a deep amount of just proud gratitude that folks are saying, and they just know I didn't change. They always be like, man, you the same person I knew. Like, you didn't lose sight of like what's important.
Yeah. Just to give that a bit more color, you focused a lot on education and mm-hmm. some of the audiences that you really value and prioritize. I worked in Baltimore City Public Schools for a year in parent and community engagement. So I worked at headquarters and I had about 10 schools I was assigned where federal funding that was earmarked for parent and community engagement within the school, I played a guidance and compliance role, helping the schools make the most of this. So sometimes that took me into the schools. I remember going into Pimlico Middle, one of my schools. It was during the lunch hour. And I think I was in the cafeteria. I think honestly, the only reason I wanted to be there was because I wanted to see the kids. I love kids. And my recollection is he was mostly sixth graders, maybe sixth and seventh graders. I sit down at one of the tables and a few of the kids, I'm in a suit. I should make that clear. And a few of the kids ask if I was a cop or a detective. And I said, no. And I told them what I did instead. And they were cool with that. Several minutes later, I leave the school. I'm still processing. I wonder why they presumed I was a detective or a police officer. They didn't have the word detective at that time. And this is my theory. I did not go back and ask the kids. But my theory is that in their neighborhoods, probably the only time they see a black man in a suit is if it's a homicide detective. The rank and file police officers are in uniform, so, you know, usually black. But if there's a man walking around your neighborhood in a suit, asking questions, you know, pretty well groomed, with some hard bottom shoes, he's probably looking into a murder. And it broke my heart that that was the reality for those kids. It was certainly the reality I grew up in. So I offer that, one, because again, this is something I'm still processing. And two, I want some of the listeners to understand the communities we are talking about, the communities we care about, and the distance you've traveled.
Yep. And Lionel, I'll speak to like something that I'm super proud of, where we're connected. We're both impacted on a specific person, and it's around education. Lionel, so I can remember a teacher at Henderson Hopkins, Mr. K, reaching out to my office and saying, I need your help. It's this young lady, she's in high school, she's going to City College, and she's special. And she's like in the 10th grade at the time, and I'm in the Maryland State Senate. And I'm like, well, Mr. K, what do you expect me to do? Like, people that's interning in our offices are typically either junior or senior, and they graduate from a four-year institution. And we were able to take on this young lady, Chimera. And Chimera had interned in our office during her junior, senior year of high school and her first year over at the University of Maryland College Park. And Lionel, I didn't realize how special. He was right. She's special. Mm-hmm. And she did all of the writing in our office. So she did the newsletter. She did some testimony, things of that nature. And I was like, this young lady is gifted. And I really got to understand that City College, because young folks are graduating from four-year institutions and don't know how to write. Hmm. But I didn't realize how City College was enthralled in making sure that these young people knew how to write. Chimera reaches out to me, I want to say maybe a couple times a year. Mm-hmm. And when I think about our city, we've been speaking about from a young man standpoint, but there are young women too. And I can remember Dolly Park is also in my district. It's the neighborhood in which Chimera was growing up. And she told me she was leaving the country for the first time. Mm-hmm. And Lionel, when I saw, because she forwarded me something and I saw your name, and I'm thinking to myself, man, I didn't get to leave the country until 30-something.
Yes.
I think that we're all Chimeras, all have the potential. But I lean into you when I saw it, because it's a program that you were running that give these young people the opportunity to be able to see something different in Baltimore, let alone not in just another state, but in mm-hmm. a whole nother country. And I don't think she was there for a week. But
right.
Like,
right.
But it was just such a beautiful person because it was the right person growing up similar to how I grew, or walking out the doors, similar door that I walked out as
That's
a child
right.
Every morning. Unimaginable potential in whatever she be. I was at a point where I was like, thank you for letting me work with her. Because I already knew she was going to hit the stars. But just to see the opportunity and see your name attached to that opportunity, man, I just say thank you, because there's only so much, and it takes a village. Like, it sounds cliche,
right.
But it really is important that no parent, no two parents is doing it by themselves. It's a collective that's amplifying and making sure that we can get these young people where they need to be. So thank you.
Corey, thank you for working with Chimera. And let me quickly fill the listeners in. One thing I do is I run a scholarship and essay competition called the Baldwin Prize in honor of James Baldwin. It's based at my high school alma mater, Baltimore City College High School, Go Knights. And Chimera won one of the biggest prizes. We had funding to send two students that summer, this would have been about two summers ago, to study abroad. And she did about 6 weeks in Rome. She did coursework. Mm-hmm. She's starting her junior year at College Park. Mm-hmm. She is the Baldwin Prize. We've been around for 10 years. We're in the process of becoming, actually just 2 days ago, I found out we were approved to become our own 501c3.
Nice. Right.
Thank you. And Chimera is one of the board members.
And oh, wow. I didn't know that. Full circle.
Chimera is on the board. The Baldwin Prize, we're part of the curriculum at City. So all roughly 350 freshman English students have to write the Baldwin Prize essay, the prompt for which I develop in partnership with the teachers, the English teachers. So Chimera ran the whole judging process. So about 300 essays, each of which has to be read twice. We get more than 100 volunteers to grade the essays online. They come from four different countries. Chimera ran that process for our last cycle. So, you see, so much of what drives me, and I hear the same thing for you, is I grew up under a certain set of circumstances. I want better for others. My perspective can be part of the solution. How the heck do we make it happen? And for me, you know, you tell me if I'm wrong, but I think that describes your career in a nutshell.
100%. I realized, like I said, I was always chasing money, but like nowadays I'm thinking, how do I scale impact? How do I do it fast? But more importantly, like, how do I add value to others? And I think that that's my life work outside of just making sure that the four young people that's coming out of my house are good human beings.
You talked about, you had this, this impressive and early real estate empire really beginning when you were 20. What is the state of that empire now?
You know what? So it's a dozen homes in the city of Baltimore. I try my best. I can't really make money now because I'm in the legislature. And when I say it takes a lot of time with the vast and volume amount of issues that we're dealing with, but I also want to make sure that I leave my children something. So I've been able to hold on to what I have. I've been doing it for 20 plus years now, but also trying to make sure that I teach the young people, especially my 16 and 18 year old, what does generational wealth look like? Why is it important to own things? How do you teach people about home ownership? What's some of the fundamentals that I did not know about appreciation, tax shelter, things of that nature? And you do it then, and also being able to provide affordable housing while doing that is super important. So I value it. I tell folks that I made more money than I lost, but now it's just about preserving for the young people that I have in my house and making sure that I pass something along to them so that they're in a better position.
That's actually a great segue just in terms of employment, wealth building. You're in a very unique position because the legislative session in Maryland runs for roughly one quarter from January through early April. So that has to be your focus during the session. Yep. You can tend to other things, but I know of legislators who, even high ranking ones, who were limited in their employment prospects because of the amount of work the session takes. Mm-hmm. And of course they have tremendous access, networks, and skills, but it could be difficult to fully deploy that in a job where you can maybe give your full attention less than 12 months per year. So has that been something you've had to navigate?
This is what I tell my young people, like, I'd never been in the legislature. So I just told you I didn't vote until my mid-20s. So I'd never been in that space. But in order to thrive, you need to understand where does the power lie, who's moving the needles. So my first 4 years in there, I had breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks. And I met with good people, bad people, in between people to fully understand how does this body work. And when I say that, it wasn't just my colleagues. I meet with staff. I meet with the librarians because I really wanted to understand how decisions get made in that space. And there are over 2,000 plus bills introduced during that quarter, the 3 months that you're talking about. There are 600 plus bills that's normally passed any given year while we're in session. I serve on the budget committee, so our work really starts early. And then serving as the subcommittee chair, you're just taking in and consuming a lot of information. So I don't have the luxury of being able to do multiple things because I really want to do that exceptionally well because people back home are counting on me, trying to make sure that this product that we're putting forward, that it reflects neighborhoods that have been disenfranchised for decades and that they're now sitting at that table. So I have to pay close attention to what's going on. So you're absolutely right. But it is one of the best experiences. And I use it as my educational ground. I used to chair public safety, transportation, and environment. So all things public safety, transportation, and environment. Then I realized a third of our budget is going out in this subcommittee over there, health and human services between Medicaid and things of that nature. So I said, I need to go learn how a third of that budget. And I've been chairing that. This is going to be my fourth session. And it's not too many conversations that you can have with me around health or human services, whether it's DDA, whether it's mental health, behavioral health, maternal health, like that, I'm not going to be able to sit in a room and have an articulate conversation.
When you mentioned earlier with respect to your real estate holdings, you said that at this point it's more about maintaining what you have than any significant growth. Is that a personal decision? Is that a decision because you're restricted through your job? Say more about that.
Yeah. So, and the legislature is part-time. So like from an ethics standpoint, anybody can see where are the houses that we own and what is the stocks that we own, what is it that we're doing from a financial standpoint. But mine is more of a personal decision. If I really want to thrive and do well at this, I can do one, I can do them both okay, or I can do them exceptionally well. So I'm able to hold on to what I have, do very well. And I tell folks, while the legislature's there, while the real estate investment is there, while the author piece is there, the most important thing that I have going on is those four children in my house and making sure that their trajectory is a lot better than mine's And you do that, you know, I make sure that they get tutoring. So after school, they go to Mathnasium, Kumon, things of that nature. They recreation, they play the most competitive. So like they play basketball. Last night, 7 to 8:30, we were in a gym with some of the most talented young folks in the Baltimore region. But like they play AAU basketball, they play soccer, they box. But I just want them to get a full understanding, because at this young age is adult lessons that they're learning. Team building, discipline, focus. To play at that level that they're playing at, these are some of the characteristics that are necessary. And I know that you are the company of the five people that you spend the most time with. So I want them around other competitive children and other young folks that understand that thriving is important.
Before we wrap, Corey, tell us one more time the name of the book, when it comes out, and how people can get their hands on it.
Lionel, I'm super excited. The Apprenticeship That Saved My Life, it drops September 30th. It's a guidebook in reference to apprenticeships, but it's also part story. So some level of memoir, because folks need something, a level to identify with. The any bookstore that you go to, local bookstore, Barnes & Nobles, Amazon, they all have it. The Apprenticeship That Saved My Life. Thank you for this opportunity just to lift that up. And hopefully, like I said, it's not just meant for students. I'm talking about parents, guidance counselors, mentors, teachers. Those that are trying to figure it out for the students will enjoy the read also.
I love it. I'm going to get my own copy, probably multiple copies. We have covered so much. It's been personal. It's been professional. I love these types of conversations.
Yeah, man. I appreciate just being able to spend this time with you.
Yeah, same here. Is there anything you'd like to share that we haven't been able to touch on up to now?
Man, I just want to lean in and say thank you. It's moments like Chimera. It's moments like folks with just similar lived experiences that are just making this space a better space. And I just want to say to the listening audience, thank you. But more importantly, my job is to give good service. My job is to make sure that I'm responsive. So if there's ever anything that I can do to be able to help, please do not hesitate to email. Please do not ever hesitate to call. I'm very responsive from this thing.
Thank you, Corey. Please keep doing what you're doing.
I appreciate you, my friend.
Music for Money Honestly is courtesy of bassist, composer, and band leader Chris Funn. It's his song Wish from the album Corner Store. Money Honestly has a newsletter. You can sign up for it at LionelFoster.com.